Hi, I'm Diane Gregg, and welcome to Invisible Women, a podcast about eight women who worked in espionage during World War II. They were from different countries, cultures, and backgrounds. What they had in common was the opportunity to step outside of societal norms, while at the same time working in the shadows. And while their contributions were incredibly important, they've been hidden. Invisible Women is an opportunity to hear their stories, to explore their roles in society, and to discover what we can learn from these stories that's relevant today.
I was always quick-minded, quick of reaction, not excitable though. I was the youngest girl and looked very innocent. Instead of 17, I looked 14. Also, I could get out of trouble, talk myself out of things. I was defiant. And if I had a problem, I would try to find a solution. And I was physically healthy, having played a lot of tennis. I was in good shape. My cover was innocence and youthfulness.
That's Pet, a young woman who lived in Amsterdam when World War II broke out. At the behest of her mother, she couriered for the Dutch resistance for 4 years, traveling into the countryside, carrying identification documents and money for downed Allied pilots. Before I tell you more about Pet's story, I'd like to talk about women through an archetypal lens. In 2012, and in the soft rain of an Irish spring, I visited the New Grange Passage Monument, erected in 3200 BCE, about 5,300 years ago, older than the Egyptian pyramids. It's a large mound on a hill, surrounded and supported by these immense oblong boulders. As I waited in line to enter this site, I contemplated the huge basalt entry stone, which lays on the ground in front of the doorway, with its well-carved Celtic spirals. I knew the spirals related to the dynamic intersection of the underground, the earth, and sky, to the early spiritual connection in which people's lives of tilling the land and hunting are directly connected with the cosmos, the turning of the earth, and its reflection in the movement of the stars, the planets, and the seasons. When my turn came to enter the narrow doorway, I shimmied slowly into the passage. One shoulder led the way and rubbed against the rough wall as I followed the others inward. The four of us were all crunched over in the dim light and silence, shuffling along. The tunnel opened up to a small circle, large enough for each of us to sit cross-legged in this domed womb-like structure. I looked up through the tunnel to the far-off transom or box window over the doorway, which was situated to directly line up with the rising sun at winter solstice. At winter solstice, the light would penetrate the mound, flowing down the tunnel to the womb, and was the precursor to the seasonal renewal and the regeneration of spring for these people. This earthly monument was the archetypal feminine earth body, and it was fertilized every year with the light occurring with the solstice. In that moment, I understood how matriarchal cultures, with the earth goddess as the creator, spun their connections around regeneration and recreation, and enacted their rites and blessings through a concrete engagement with the timeless archetype, giving their lives meaning and hope. Known now as the great goddess archetype, she was the creator, and her body, the universe. The experience of New Grange felt as though it pulled on an archaic remnant of time past in me, a history I had no knowledge of but could relate to in a basic way through entering into the mound. It felt as though there was a receding of something long past in me, a deep connection to the feminine, perhaps. Before I go on, I'd like to explain that archetypes are inherited forms of the mind common to all human beings based on centuries of evolution. These unconscious primordial structures of the psyche help us structure incoming sensory information into coherent patterns. Depending on our lives and culture, some are more active at times than others, and these forms work in a dynamic way with our everyday lives. and therefore may be reflected out into the world differently at different times. From archaeological studies, we know the most ancient goddess societies worship the Great Mother, who was beyond time and space. She was the mystery and beyond all pairs of opposites, like male or female. The maternal as archetype may well have been the first transpersonal principle to be the object of religious awe and veneration. And not only some other goddess archetypes still widely revered in the Virgin Mary, but her adoration has been revived or regenerated in the earth as Gaia. The underlying archetypal pattern for all of these is the same, but there are differences in the archetype's reflection in our lives at different times. The original Great Mother archetype, as embodied at New Grange, represents a larger continuum of feminine attributes that affirms the constant creative power of the cosmos, the cyclic process of birth and death, and therefore the link between creativity and destruction, the greatest powers of this archetype, the capacity of regeneration. And it is thought that it is specifically because of this power that matriarchal lineages and spirituality were forced underground. In the Neolithic period, beginning from about 9500 BCE, and during the time New Grange was built, their spirituality was well formed. A dynamic and complex religion had developed based on the triple moon goddess as giver of life, wielder of death, and regenerix. And for nearly 30,000 years, these moon-based societies existed around the world. However, during the Bronze and Iron Ages, between about 3500 and 500 BCE, the northern Indo-European tribes invaded Western Europe, the Near East, and India. In socio-political waves and over centuries, there is a documented shift to the rise of authoritarian cultures and the ascendancy of male gods, such as Zeus, Apollo, and Gilgamesh. There was a dismissal of the cyclic nature of this earth-based spirituality, and the female deities such as Diana, Isis, Artemis, and Demeter were replaced by male gods. With the rise of a new cultural perspective, aspects of the great feminine archetype became associated with darkness, evil, impurities, the earth, and death. Hence the rites associated with this spirituality, including cyclic regeneration, and their death and sacred sex rites were abolished. And the teachings associated with these, once acknowledged through ceremony and ritual similar to that which took place at New Grange, were lost and no longer passed down through the generations. Some were forgotten, some psychologically repressed, and some were assimilated into the authoritarian culture that developed. Aspects of everyday life, values, ideals, grounded in the cyclic turning of the cosmos, and associated with this archetype became lost, and its fullness became invisible. What everyday women and men lost was the connection to a spirituality that reflected a feminine face of assertiveness, power, cultural accomplishment, independence, interconnectivity, compassion, sexuality, and a fuller imaginal capacity. With the destruction of the idea of cyclic renewal through a linear consciousness-related culture, these aspects were relegated to the unconscious, to collective and individual shadows. These powerful, earthy, embodied, and now dark and unconscious energetic aspects were eclipsed and became symbolized in our culture, for example, as the Wicked Witch or Baba Yaga. Why is this important today? A previously well-balanced and grassroots spirituality based on the feminine as creator, but celebrating a non-dual stance, an inclusive female-male stance at its center, became unbalanced, and this unbalancing is mirrored in the individual and cultural unconscious of Western society today. Although the fuller continuum of the archetype never flourished again in Western culture, its influence has undulated quietly throughout history, never quite disappearing. For instance, in the 11th and 12th centuries in Western society, there was a revival of aspects of a fuller feminine as she was resurrected through Mary, the mother of Jesus, being the Notre Dame of European cathedrals. The great cathedral at Chartres, for instance, is dedicated to Mary, with its large 11-channel inlaid tile labyrinth. The labyrinth design is based on the spiral and is a cross-cultural symbol. I visited Chartres, and standing in the middle of its well-worn labyrinth and gazing up at the stained glass rose window, which is a perfect replica of the labyrinth's rose center, I realized that the design was appropriated from matriarchal cultures and from monuments like Newgrange. I was in a circle within a sophisticated spiral passage, and I was embraced by the ethereal light flowing in from the window above the sanctuary's entry. The purposeful design were remnants and proof of that ancient spiritual symbology and spirituality being incorporated into this Christian religious structure. I will discuss feminine archetypal history further in episode 6, but for now, I'd like to turn to the women's espionage narratives. As I've mentioned in previous episodes, the chaos of war brings with it a disruption of social barriers. World War II was a time when women stepped into jobs previously reserved for men. Whether in the factories, the resistance, or the military, they were in auxiliary positions to men. The power gradient was the same as pre-war. If a power vacuum did occur, giving women an advantage, for instance, during espionage activities, it was only during those activities. After the war, their self-agency was reduced as cultural norms defaulted to pre-war form. However, not only were women able to fill that power vacuum when given a chance in espionage, there are also examples of women operating in a collective, parallel way by forming an empowered sisterhood. This sisterhood was assertive, action-oriented, interconnected, compassionate, imaginative, and made wide-reaching contributions independent of men. This solidarity and sisterhood agency may be witnessed in spite of the dominant culture of the day. For example, women were not only a consistent force within the infrastructure of the resistance, that is, providing their homes as meeting places, doing reconnaissance and couriering, bearing arms, but they also, among themselves, formed secret, interconnecting alliances, being allies for each other, within the resistance and within their families. As you will hear clearly in Pet's story today, the women had a different set of values. They worked together in a parallel way to the general resistance movement, an example of a group of women acting as a cell within a cell, and this was not uncommon. However, to do this, there was a secrecy in a choosing not to share information with the men in the resistance or in the family. This was a strategy so that their sisterhood beliefs, agency, and accomplishments could be maintained and not interfered with. They had their own way of doing things, separate from the men, taking huge risks with astuteness, strategy, and creativity. They were not helpless, nor did they need supervision. Since many of these characteristics were not part of the greater cultural beliefs about women, we could say they pulled from the fuller continuum of the archetypal feminine held within the collective unconscious of Western culture, and that there was a reawakening and receding of that great archetypal energy. So although the archetypal feminine flourished for thousands of years in matriarchal cultures and has been deeply forgotten for at least the last 500 years, we may still find her undulating through history and our lives. This receding of a fuller archetypal feminine in the World War II era and its repression by the dominant culture post-war was redirected, becoming the fuel for the women's equal rights movements of the 1960s and 1970s. Now I'd like to introduce you to Pat. Pat was a young woman who grew up in Amsterdam and began currying for the Dutch resistance at the bequest of her mother. In 2004, and arriving at Pat's apartment, she cheerfully invited me into her sitting room. Having a keen appreciation of art, she had been a collector for over 50 years. Her private collection included Inuit sculpture, antique Moroccan carpets, bronze, Buddhist heads, and original paintings. And one had a commanding presence above the fireplace, a large abstract oil painting of a woman. Pet was athletic and noble-looking in a black velour pants outfit with an elegant gold brooch. Her hair in a bun was neatly pulled back, away from her youthful-looking face. I began by asking her her story of World War II.
My brother was involved early on. He falsified papers for his resistance cell. I found out because I was the one cleaning his room and discovered them on his desk. I told my mother, and she knew already, of course, and said, "Forget about it." My mother had given me identification cards, falsified birth certificates, food coupons, and money, which I put in a pouch she had sewn in my underwear. It was easier for a woman, as we were freer during the early war days, to come and go. I took the train and headed for the countryside. It was a five-hour trip with a change of trains in East Holland, near the German border. I was to deliver the contents of the pouch to various farms where downed Allied pilots were hiding, but I missed my train stop. I disembarked at the next station and had to walk the 20 kilometers back to the previous town. It was a long journey, and the SS had completely surrounded this particular train stop and were searching people looking for exactly what I was carrying. I had no protection, so I just began to walk away, not bringing attention to myself. I looked younger than my age. All of a sudden, near a dike, I saw a man's face sticking out of the water among the reeds. He saw me and motioned to me with his eyes to keep walking. I said nothing and kept walking. In a few minutes, and from behind me, I heard the commotion of this man being dragged up the bank, and as I briefly turned, I witnessed the inhumanity of the Nazi behavior. Oh, I felt so sorry for him. He was absolutely sopping wet, being dragged out of the water, and so badly handled by the SS. I was baptized into what you could expect if caught. They let me pass through the cordoned off area, and I continued to walk down the road in the direction the train had come. Then, I wasn't very far along when I heard the marching sounds of a troop of Gestapo or SS. They were walking much faster than I was able to walk, and they stopped me and asked me what I was doing. I told them I was going to visit some friends. They emptied my suitcase onto the sidewalk. They took my extra panties and held them up, made noise, everything on the ground, and then eventually they just left laughing. I adamantly waited. I stood on the road until they had finished, and they could not see me. I did not want them to see me humiliated, you know? Then I picked it all up and walked on. It was terrifying because of everything I had on me. I did arrive at the correct town, and I found the farmer I was to stay with. The farmers were paid by the government to care for downed Allied pilots. They took a lot of risk. And the next day, the farmer gave me a bike, and I went off to three or four more farms delivering documents. Sometimes the farmers would meet me, and I would not get lost. Very rural. Farms not on routes. Trails for carts to go over, not like today. I would always return to the first farm to sleep, usually in a room with two or three others who were helping the resistance or hiding out. That was my routine. for 2 to 3 days each trip from about the fall of 1941, when things were getting rough, to 1944, when there was so little food. I no longer had the energy to travel. In hindsight, there were many women who worked with the resistance couriering or hiding Jewish children, but for the most part, only men received any medals. Oh, there was a young woman who worked for a resistance cell who was shot by the Germans. Apparently, she seduced Germans and then shot them. That is the story, anyhow. She received the Medal of Resistance because she died. That's the only way a woman got one. One day, a farmer met me with his bike, and as we were traveling on a trail, he pointed out some bramble bushes, explaining that there was a young Jewish woman with a baby hiding in the ground underneath the bushes. I asked why she had to live in a hole in the ground, and he said that it was too dangerous for the others at the farm in case the baby started crying when the SS came to search it. It was really far from anywhere. This is what people were doing. I did learn later from one of the people I knew that were underground, the young mother with her baby was there from 1942 to 1945, and she did survive. Then there were continual and more serious risks for us, as the Nazis soon came to know that the farms along the German border were hiding people, and the SS would routinely search them. The farmer who was my main contact was shot by the Nazis in the last year. It was terrible. It was before D-Day, and a Dutch pilot who had been flying for the German Air Force out of a large military airport in Holland contacted the underground, asking where he could bail out. He was supposed to fly this German general to Normandy and instead wanted to bail out over farmland. You know, there were thousands of Dutch soldiers who had to serve the Germans, and they hated that. Once over the fields, he shot the general and then bailed. The SS came looking for the plane right away, and he attacked them with a machine gun, killing them. Then he was taken to the farm, and the SS came looking for him. He was wild and had been warned that he was putting the others in danger. But he went haywire when the Nazis came to the farm to search for him. They found him and killed him, and the farmer. But they did not find the other Allied pilots hiding. One day you knew someone, and the next, they were gone. Life was more temporary. One day I was surprised when I entered the farmhouse and walking by the kitchen door saw 9 Allied men in pilot uniforms sitting around the pot stove and the farmer's wife at the counter. I looked right in and she didn't say a word, closed the door. They looked at me. She never said a word about it. Soon those that were hiding, one would say, "Oh, pet, please bring me a newspaper or a certain magazine," and that's what I would do. It was easier to hide people on the farm. In the farmhouse, there was an area where there was no basement, but if you lifted the floorboards, there was a space high enough for men to lie down, and that's where they were, just under the floorboards in the back of the house, lying face up. But I did not know that until after the war was over. Mother also hid a Jewish family on the top floor of our Amsterdam townhouse. They were our neighbors. It was very risky, and the 2 young Jewish children had to be kept quiet. All the family's meals and laundry had to be done and taken up to them. They had to stay, live, and eat in the attic. Then towards the end of the war, 2 young Jewish girls whose families had been murdered by the Nazis came to live with us too. One had terrible nightmares and would scream out for her family in the night. I shared a room with her. Finally, my mother brought in a hypnotist to help her with the nightmares, and under hypnotism, we discovered the gruesome details of the execution of her parents, which I heard her recount. They're so gruesome that I will not relay them now. One day, the Nazis cordoned off the street we lived on to round up Jews in the neighborhood. They came to search our flat, and my mother sent my pretty sister, who was 24 at the time, down to flirt with them. The soldiers stopped on the stairs as she smiled and feigned interest in them, and they never ended up going upstairs. They never tried to search the apartment again. If they had found out about the family in the attic, all of us would have been executed. My father, being a financier, was imprisoned just after the pogrom began. They barged into the house, cleaned out the safe. The financial securities were taken. The Nazis were taking everything from the Jews, but also anyone who had some wealth. The Germans sold the securities in Switzerland. This was against international law. Switzerland was not supposed to buy them, but everyone knows the Swiss were not really neutral. We knew we had to get him out of prison. We were very worried for his life and frightened. Inmates would be lined up routinely in the middle of the city. 50 to 100 of them would be shot any time the resistance achieved a significant hit on the German army. The pogrom was getting more intense. At first, we did not know what had happened or where he might be. Then, one day, the doorbell rang and a man was standing there. You could see he had just come out of jail, very pale and sickly looking. He asked if he was at the right address and if my mother was in. I took him into the living room. He asked to speak with my mother alone. He told my mother where my dad was, and if we didn't get him out in the next 2 weeks, we would probably not see him again. My eldest brother knew a professor that played chess every Saturday with the head of the Gestapo in Amsterdam. He talked to him about my father's release, and the professor asked him. The Gestapo head said, "Send a young woman to pick him up." My brother asked my pretty sister to go with a set of forged papers to the jail on such and such a day, and she did come home with father. We waited at the streetcar. We told one of the Jewish girls living with us at the time not to come downstairs, as it would be a shock to father. Mother did not tell him that we were hiding our Jewish neighbors or the girls. He was in bad shape and in the same clothes he had left with. He had been in solitary confinement for 3.5 months and badly beaten. Also, he had witnessed the atrocities of women being humiliated and tortured from his cell. This was especially hard on him, but we did not know about that until much later. He didn't talk about what happened at first. My siblings and I thought our parents should go to the country to recuperate, and we made arrangements. And the next morning, they were going to catch the early train. But the whole street was cordoned off, and they were rounding up Jewish people. We said our father needed to recuperate due to his health, but they sent us back home. I was always quick-minded, quick of reaction, not excitable, though. I was the youngest girl and looked very innocent. Instead of 17, I looked 14. Also, I could get out of trouble, talk myself out of things. I was defiant. And if I had a problem, I would try to find a solution. And I was physically healthy, having played a lot of tennis. I was in good shape. My cover was innocence and youthfulness. Behind enemy lines, you continually had to live with the perils and angst of the situation. We had no control. Some see war as a mythic, heroic action, but if you are in the trenches of it, it is not. But those on the outside can easily mythologize about it. People have no idea unless they have lived it. Even our basic, everyday activities were lost, especially when the pogrom began and the street was cordoned off. Later in the war, as you know, we had no food. People starved. By 1942, there were Germans at either end of our block with machine guns. the day they blocked their neighborhood, three Jewish families committed suicide to avoid being taken away. That is when my mother took in a Jewish family on our street. They also put resistance workers on the trains to the camps. If you were caught in the resistance, man or woman, you went to the concentration camps or were killed on the spot. I saw one man from our resistance cell taken away. Of course, I did not know his real name, but he had been especially kind to my pregnant sister, whose husband died fighting for Holland. It was toward the end of the war, and in the city we had very little food. It was just before the winter famine. The farmers had more food, of course. The farmer told me to bring a bigger suitcase next time, and so I brought my father's suitcase, and they filled it with bacon, flour, and other food. I was late for the train, so I dropped my bike in the usual place. The farmer would retrieve it later, and the train was closed for tickets, so I had to run into the station to buy the ticket. And there was a man standing there, and I said to him, "Would you please take my suitcase to first class?" I got my ticket and found my seat, which was beside another woman. The farmer had also given me a sandwich, and I offered her half. And she said, "I wouldn't take anything from a collaborator." And I said, "I'm not a collaborator." She said, "Yes, that man who put your suitcase into the overhead. He's a food inspector for the Germans, and they took everything from me." I explained I was late and that I was not a collaborator. I had just asked him to put my suitcase up. I'm not sure if she really believed me, but she did take half my sandwich. So spontaneous. I felt very lucky, as food was so tight, and if he had opened it, he would have been very suspicious, and he would have apprehended me. "What you need to do, you don't talk about it," my mother used to say. During the war, I never talked about it either, to anyone except my mother. It was not done. I have no idea how many other women were involved with the resistance, but there were many, many women involved, and for us, a few family members, too. She was kind and compassionate. She was a role model. That is, she was defiant. And she taught us to stand up and help other people who needed us. It was my mother who agreed to hide the Jewish family in the attic. My father never knew about them or the two Jewish girls. Mother taught us how to interact with the world emotionally, socially, morally. Mother had different values and a different way of looking at the world. Father taught us how to interact practically, that is, in money situations. Father had other strengths and would not have exposed us the way mother did. Mother died shortly after the war ended of internal bleeding from unknown causes. But I think we had so little food that she gave all of it up for us. Oh, she was so thin. The Netherlands went through a famine in the last year. We had no food. Many died from starvation. And my father asked me to take my mother's place in the household. And I was also taking care of my sister's two boys because she was away helping another family. It was a lot of work, and the war had taken its toll on all of us. Within 3 months, I became ill with meningitis, pleurisy, and pneumonia. Because my father had many contacts through his business, a doctor, a specialist, sent experimental medication from Switzerland, which pulled me through. I remember my father going to meet the plane to pick up the medication. I was in bed around the clock nursing for 3 months and then did not fully recover for over a year. My doctor at the time told me that I would not have a long life due to the illness. And I told him then, "You are wrong. I will live a very long life." And I have. Throughout my life, I've easily predicted what is going to happen next. I worked by my instincts. I have good instincts, and my instincts and intuition were honed during the war.
There was something Pet had said that I wanted to ask about. It was when her father was being held, and the head of the Gestapo had said,
"Send a young woman to pick him up."
It was obviously a very dangerous thing to do, especially with forged documents. So why did her brother send her pretty sister?
To flirt with them. It all helped. But later in the war, she was raped. It was dangerous work. You never knew what would happen. We lived with a lot of angst. It was terrorizing. You know, I had to take Adivan before we meet so that I don't get too upset talking about it all. No one has asked me before, and I think it's important to talk about. Because people here don't want to know what happened. They have no idea what women did in the war. Women are sometimes stronger than men. Look at what my mother did.
Before we parted, I asked Pat about how she came to live in Canada.
One of my sisters had moved to BC, and I came to visit her and stayed. I married a Canadian, my first husband. He was an accountant, and I was much younger than him. We spent 2 years on the Alaskan Highway. I organized a strike for the waitresses as they weren't being paid enough. We moved to Vancouver and lived here, but he developed early-onset dementia. I took care of him at home for 4 years. It was very hard. It was his best friend who told me that he had dementia as I was in denial. He said, "You have to realize and face it." I ended up marrying him. My husband is Polish, and in the war was flying for the RAF, dropping SOE agents behind enemy lines. So he knew what the war was like. He suffered more than I did. He's Jewish and lost all of his family and extended family in Warsaw. His home was completely razed. We don't talk about it much, of course. Life is so interesting. We have to consciously make adjustments, and it is worth working at it. The readjustments make one richer. There is beauty in life.
That was Pet's story. Lucia Frangioni was the voice of Pat. On the next episode of Invisible Women, I'll continue to explore women through an archetypal lens. That's what's coming up on the next episode. Please visit us on the web, where you'll find additional information and resources. And I'd like to invite you to leave comments or ask questions you may have, and subscribe to the newsletter. You can do that on the website at www.invisiblewomen.ca. This podcast is produced by Robert We Met. I'm Diane Gregg. Thanks for listening.